From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dick Miller got his start in Hollywood, acting in Roger Corman's low-budget quickies like Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors. Miller made such an impression on would-be directors like Scorsese, Spielberg, and Dante that they went on to cast him in their own movies. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with actor Dick Miller. Also, journalist A.C. Green gives us a first-hand account of living with another person's heart. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc taken from Pierre Boulez's TV series on classical music. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush expressed concern tonight that portions of his UN speech may have been misinterpreted. The president said that after Iraq withdraws from Kuwait, there may be opportunities to settle regional problems, including the conflict that divides Arabs and Israel. Some reports were interpreting that remark as a link between the Persian Gulf crisis and Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The president later denied making any such link and stressed that everything depends on Iraq withdrawing from Kuwait. Israeli Deputy Prime Minister David Levy addressed the United Nations today, warning that Israel would respond harshly to an Iraqi attack. Linda Fasulo has more from the UN.
From the rostrum of the General Assembly, Deputy Prime Minister David Levy reminded the UN that Saddam Hussein has threatened to attack Israel in revenge for Security Council resolutions. The Deputy Prime Minister said that the free world should know that Israel will not sacrifice its security as the price for their economic well-being and freedom. He warned that if attacked, Israel knows how to defend itself, and its response will be harsh and painful. But, he said, this reality doesn't absolve the international community from taking measures under U.S. leadership against Iraq. On the Arab-Israeli conflict, he said the willingness of Arab states to end the state of war against Israel would help to advance the solution to the Palestinian problem. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo reporting at the UN.
A newspaper in Beirut says agreement has been reached between Syria and Iran for the release of Western hostages in Lebanon. The newspaper, Al-Diyar, reported the arrangements were concluded during a visit to Iran last week by President Assad of Syria. In Nicosia, Gerald Butt reports diplomats expect some hostages to be released shortly.
The Beirut newspaper report says that President Assad of Syria and President Rafsanjani of Iran last week cleared the ground for the release of Westerners in Lebanon. But when all of them will be released still isn't clear. Shiite leaders have said that the six Americans can't expect to be released while U.S. forces are deployed in Saudi Arabia. But the prospects for the three Britons are much brighter, following the announcement last week that the governments in London and Tehran are restoring diplomatic relations. Diplomats in Beirut say the way is now clear for Britons held in Lebanon to be freed, and they say it's only a matter of time before other Westerners are released, because the truth is, the era of the kidnapping of Westerners in Lebanon is now over. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
The stock market was up sharply today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 63 points to close at 2,515.81. Volume was 202 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Roger Corman first made his reputation as the king of the quick, cheap genre film. My guest Dick Miller was in dozens of those films, like A Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, Sorority Girl, The Terror, The Trip, and War of the Satellites. Several of the directors who grew up watching Corman's movies or got their start working for him later paid homage to Miller by casting him in their films. Martin Scorsese gave him the part of a club owner in New York, New York. Miller had a small part in Jonathan Demme's Swing Shift. Joe Dante cast Miller in every one of his films, including The Howling, Gremlins, and Gremlins 2, where he plays the neighbor who comes to visit just as the gremlin invasion begins. Before he made films, Dick Miller lived in New York, where he was writing, producing, and directing for TV and theater. He went to Los Angeles, hoping to write screenplays, but he met Roger Corman, who offered him a role in a film.
He was doing his I believe, a second film, a picture called Apache Woman with Lloyd Bridges. And the guy who introduced me said, Dick's a writer. You need any scripts? He says, I got plenty of writers. I don't need any scripts. I need actors. I said, I'm an actor. He said, okay, I'll stick you in a movie. I played an Indian in my first picture. And about halfway through, he asked me, he said, would you like to play a cowboy? I said, you're doing another movie already? He says, no, in the same movie. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, come back next week, you'll play a cowboy in town. So I wound up playing a cowboy and an Indian in my first movie. And Donnie came close to shooting myself in the final shootout scene at the end.
Did anybody in the audience notice that it was the same person who was a cowboy and an Indian?
I don't think so, since it was so early. I mean, there was nothing to recognize. Nobody could say, oh, I've seen him before. A lot of dark makeup and some nose plugs. And the difference was, you could tell that if you look close, if somebody said that's the same guy, you'd say, oh, of course it is. But I don't think anybody was looking that close.
Did you have to learn how to ride a horse for the movie?
Oh, yeah, the old Hollywood story. Can you ride? Yes, you know. Can you jump out of an airplane? Sure. Without a parachute, of course. You know, they ask you all kinds of things, and you got to lie and say, of course I can do that. I had ridden a little up to that point, horses in stables in Central Park and places like that, and dude ranches, but nothing like cowboys and Indians. And I just figured, I've seen it done, I can do it. And that's pretty much how I learned. I learned on the first picture.
You played the lead in the 1959 Roger Corman movie, Bucket of Blood, and this has become a real cult classic. It was the leading role. You were a waiter in a beatnik coffee house, and you become an artist by covering first your dead cat in clay and then by killing people and covering the corpses in clay and passing it off as sculpture. And once this artist becomes really acclaimed, you also become quite the hipster. Was it fun to spoof the hipster in the movie?
Well, it was made at the height of the coffee shop era. Everybody was going in for espresso.
You mean the coffee house, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the basic idea behind the picture was the hipster coffee house groupies at that time and the people who hung around and the no talents and the talents of that era. And I think later on Roger Corman made a picture called The Trip about the first, you know, big psychedelic outings that were going on, which was a little more serious. But it was also meant to cover that genre of what was happening at the moment. I love making Bucket of Blood. I think it still stands as my favorite picture.
The movie was shot in, I think, 5 days. Can you give us an idea of how you made a movie that quickly?
Well, 5 days was not as tight as it seemed. They were making TV half-hour shows in 2.5 days then. And people who had that down had that type of, that was a finger snap.
Right.
People who had that down at that moment could make movies that fast. We were, when I started with Roger, we were making Westerns. And we would make them in 6 days. And that was, seemed like a fair amount of time. And later on we got an extra day, a seventh day or an eighth day. And I thought, this is great, what a luxury. So by the time we got around to making a Bucket of Blood, 5 days was kind of a press, but most of the picture was shot in two sets, so it wasn't that much of a push. It's a matter of learning the technique. I think later on, when he made the famous Little Shop of Horrors, which was supposed to have been made in 2 days, and actually 2 days and a couple of spare nights, that also wasn't too much of a push. The people who were involved in it seemed to think, well, 2 days, okay, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, we'll add another day.
But I understand you were offered the lead in Little Shop of Horrors, but you turned it down. Why didn't you take it?
I have a track record of turning down a lot of pictures for a lot of unknown reasons, even to myself. I think at that time, and I was hungry in those days, I would turn down jobs and say, I don't want to do it. I turned down Little Shop of Horrors because I had just finished doing Bucket of Blood, and I thought I was being asked to do the same character again. This was before they had sequels. If I had known it was going to be a sequel or a sequel character, I probably would have done it and been very happy. I kind of regretted it over the years. I turned it down kind of on an artistic level. I said, I've done this part. I don't want to do it again. Give it to somebody else. Give it to Jonathan, who was a very close personal friend of mine at the time. And I felt, give him the shot. I don't care. I said, I'll do anything in it.
Well, the role you did end up playing in Little Shop of Horrors was someone who's always hanging out in the flower shop eating the flowers. You were the plant-eating person instead of the
Yes.
Instead of the man-eating plant. and for people who don't know the story, it's the story of a guy who creates this plant, and the plant eats, the plant thrives on blood, so he's always killing people to feed the plant. So did you actually eat carnations for your role?
Yeah, they suggested that this was the character was going to do this, and I thought, okay, fine, I'll take a bite. When you say cut, I'm going to spit it out and get rid of it. And the only drawback was that the carnations, I'm sure, Roger didn't go out and buy the freshest flowers. I don't know where he got them. They were kind of stale and old, and they were probably full of pesticides. But once I got them in my mouth, they didn't taste so bad. So I figured I'll chew them up, and I'll see what happens. And it worked out fine. I actually became a flower eater from that picture.
You became a flower eater?
I've been known to steal centerpieces at weddings and things like that and take them home and eat them.
Seriously?
Oh, yes.
You're not pulling my leg on this?
No, I like flowers. If I get a chance, it's not a constant thing. Don't think it's a way of life with me. I go around eating flowers all the time. But I'll find myself maybe once a year or twice a year eating a rose or something that tastes good.
Huh. You know, Roger Corman says that Bucket of Blood and Little Shop of Horrors were a part of a new genre that he felt he was creating, the black comedy horror film. And I was wondering if you felt that all the actors had a good sense of humor, the kind of sense of humor that would get all of what was happening in the movie, you know, and enjoy the jokes.
I think at the time he was making those films, Roger didn't have the greatest sense of humor. I have to be honest about that. He wasn't quite sure that Bucket of Blood was going to be a comedy. He thought it was kind of a very serious thriller at the time. That's the truth. And all the people involved with him at the time had great senses of humor. I mean, it was not uncommon for us on location shots to play what you would call dirty tricks on Roger, because he didn't quite catch on to what we were doing at the time. But I'm not saying that he was ignorant of the fact that it was going to be a comedy. I think about halfway through, he got the idea that this is funny. You know, these people are funny. And when he finished it, he said, we've got to make another one. This is how Little Shop of Horrors came about. He said, this is funny. We must make another picture just like it.
Give me an example of the kind of dirty trick that the actors would play on Corman.
It wasn't really a group thing. It was, I think it was more Jonathan Hayes and myself. We had an expression, show me what you mean. He would say, we were out in Hawaii shooting a picture. He said, run out there to the end of the coral and look around and then come running back. And we'd say, show us what you mean, Roger. And he'd run out there and come back and his feet would be bloody through his sneakers. I mean, it was just the coral would cut him up something awful. Or he would say, leap over this ditch, grab those bushes and pull yourself into the cane field. Well, we were told never touch the cane, the sugar cane. It's got these little burrs on it. And somebody would say, show us what you mean, Roger. He'd jump, he'd grab the bushes, and we'd take out an hour while somebody washed his hands out.
Well, did he expect you to do it after he proved that this was a really dangerous and impossible thing to do?
Yes, and we'd do it. I mean, once it was shown to us, we said, okay, fine, you know. But we usually took more precautions than he had taken.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. How come you stayed with Roger Corman for so long, and how long was it?
Let's see. When I went to work for Roger, I was not that serious about my career. I still didn't know if I wanted to be a writer, although I had stopped writing the minute I worked in as an actor in movies. I just said, this is kind of nice. I found it very easy to work for him. He was doing a lot of work, and I mean as many as 5 or 6 films a year, which is unheard of. The studios, you know, major studios barely turn out that kind of product. So I stayed with Roger 5 or 6 years and wound up doing about 35 films for him in that period. The work was easy. It was constant. I didn't have to look for jobs, which is the most difficult part of being an actor, I think. Mm-hmm. And I found myself every couple of months, I'd get a call from him and say, we're going to do another picture, and we got a nice part for you. And as the roles got better, it became easier and easier to stay in that position.
Did he always write a role for you?
He didn't write a role for me. I will always be grateful to Roger for the fact that he didn't write roles for me. He let me do almost any part that came up. I think the opening picture was kind of the sign of which way we were going. I played a cowboy and an Indian. Well, you're not going to typecast me that way. You know? You're not going to say this guy does cowboys only or Indians only. I suddenly found myself playing rocket scientists, demented busboys, leading men, villains, everything. And he never said, you can't do that part. You know, he'd say, can you do this? Can you do that? I said, I can do anything. And I found myself in 35 pictures playing practically 35 different roles. I don't think many actors get that kind of opportunity.
How soon did you try to establish your career away from Corman?
I think that happened. It's a stage of life you go through. It's more than a career change. After so many years, I started to put on a little weight and get a little heavy, and was entering middle age, and there wasn't that much work around for me. He said, "You want to play truck drivers or you know, redneck sheriffs?" So it seemed like I was not getting the work I wanted, and by that time, I had established a fairly good name in the business, and that was the first time I really started to move out and see if I could work for other people. I don't say it was a fallow period, but there wasn't that much work, and then suddenly it started again. I guess I lost weight, I changed my image, I built up some muscles, and I started a new career again.
Mm-hmm. So when you changed your image and you started again, what kind of roles did you get?
Now it was pretty definite that I was not going to be doing too many leading roles. Because again, the age group was different, and you don't find yourself doing that many parts. I was playing gangsters and cops. I was doing the same thing I had done before, only in smaller parts. And then things would come up like Heart Like a Wheel. And then The Howling. I had met Joe Dante. I think that was probably the big change in my career. And we got along pretty good, and he asked me to do something in Hollywood, Hollywood Boulevard. And it turned out to be one of my favorite parts. I just love the scenes. It wasn't a big part, but it seemed to be very outstanding when it was all done. And based on that, I went to work doing a lot more pictures in that genre, the new horror films and the films of that nature.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is actor Dick Miller. This is Fresh Air. Actor Dick Miller is my guest, and he's performed in dozens of Roger Corman films, including Little Shop of Horrors and Bucket of Blood. He's appeared in every one of Joe Dante's movies, including Gremlins 2. He's been in New York, New York, The Terminator. For a couple of years, he was on the Fame television series. He's made many, many movies over the years. Well, Joe Dante has cast you in every one of the movies that he's made. And I think that a lot of the people who became well-known directors after working for Roger Corman ended up casting you in their films. You know, Joe Dante is an example. Alan Arkush, you were in his Rock and Roll High School. Help me out with this. What are some other examples?
Okay, Marty Scorsese.
Yeah, New York, New York. You played a club owner.
Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan.
Mm-hmm. So were you self-conscious
Steven
about
Spielberg,
this?
Oh, really? not to overlook Steven.
Were you self-conscious about this, knowing that people were paying homage to you in a way? I mean, they'd seen you in all these movies. Do you know what I mean? And your parts were, in a way, an homage to yourself.
I was flattered, and I think probably Scorsese was the first one who summed it up for me when he was doing New York, New York. I went to see him, and I said, "What do you want me to read?" And he says, "I've been watching you since I'm 13 years old. You don't have to read for me, you know." He says, "You got the part. Bobby De Niro's going to come in here, and we'll try some ad-libs and see how you got that feeling with each other," which we did. And that was it. And I suddenly realized there were a lot of guys out there who started watching me when they were young teenagers and spent 10, 15 years watching me. And now they're grown up and they're producing and directing and writing and they want to use me. And I really was flattered. It took a while for it to reach me, but once it did, I was truly flattered.
You know, after working on all these quickie movies, like cheap quickie movies. What was it like, for instance, to work with Martin Scorsese on New York, New York, playing in a scene with Robert De Niro, and he's so famous for spending a really long time intensely getting into his character. And I'm sure it's, in a way, the opposite approach that actors had to take in the quickie Corman films, where you've got 2 days to shoot the whole movie.
Well, Bobby De Niro, actually, well, he started with Roger. He's also from that school.
Oh, I didn't realize he'd started with him, too.
Along with Nicholson. And if you put these guys to the test, you'll find out that they all know how to work fast. When the luxury of time came their way, then they started to use it. But basically, De Niro was right on top of, you know, let's shoot quick, let's get it done, let's get it over with. Except his particular style is to stretch it out and ad-lib and see how long he can make the scenes and everything. I've worked with a lot of people, and those who come from that background are all seem to be able to do that. It's not a big thing. Today the school of doing that is probably the soaps. They get to work in soaps, and they have to learn a script in one day and go in and do it. So I think the background of most actors, somewhere along the line, if they've had any experience at all, covers that type of fast work, rapid work. There are people who get into the business, they get in lucky, young kids, and they really don't have any background at all. They're looking to establish a mood or create some inner feeling of some kind, it's a lot of unnecessary activity.
Actor Dick Miller is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I'm from the Apple, New York. I grew up a combination of places there, Long Island, the Bronx, Manhattan. Did many, many things before I became an actor. I was always interested in show business, but I kind of saw myself as a singer and a musician. I played drums professionally for a while. I was with Bobby Sherwood, the big band leader, for a while, although I didn't work in his big band. I worked in small groups with him. And always kind of thought of myself that I would be a singer one day. I worked at that for a while professionally and really didn't care for it so much, to be singing for other people.
What kind of material did you sing?
Pops, kind of like Nat Cole and Frank Sinatra, that genre. I was just a pop singer. A lot of jazz, though. Mm-hmm. I love jazz, and that was the world I played in, played drums in the jazz world. And I like that kind of music. I remember taking a fling at acting when I was about 15 or 16 years old. A friend said, "Do you want a free summer vacation? All you have to do is paint some flats for me, and there's free food, free room, free girls, everything you want to spend your summer with." And I went up there and I painted flats for a while, and I was watching the acting, and I said, "I can do that." And he gave me a shot out. He says, "You're going to play a butler." And I had very few lines. I won't make this a long, boring story. I wound up forgetting every line. And I was going, and the other actor on stage who I was working with had been pre-warned, and he took all my lines, and he made him questions and said, "Yes, there's somebody here to see me. Do you want to show him in?" And he did all of that, and it, big laugh for everybody. But by the end of the summer, I had turned out to be the company character actor, and I enjoyed it. But I didn't touch it again for 4 or 5 years.
Weren't you also a psychologist?
Yes, I'm a graduate psychologist. I went to Columbia and worked at that briefly, and decided I didn't want to be dealing with the crazy people. And then I came out to Hollywood, where everybody's nuts. It served me a good standing. I thought at one time I would do that. I come from a family of professionals, mostly lawyers. I have my kid brother is a Supreme Court justice in New York State, and my older brother was the coroner of Orange County and also an attorney. And my nephews, I'm probably the only non-attorney in my family, and I thought, well, I'll do something along those lines. But I didn't enjoy it. It's not that I didn't enjoy it; it's that I enjoyed the world of music and acting better. So I just kind of drifted into it.
I'm wondering if any of the patients that you had during the brief time that you were a psychologist ended up seeing your movies like Bucket of Blood and wondering, this is the guy who is going to help me?
That would be very funny. I don't know. Most of the people I was dealing with were I worked at Bellevue for a while, and the cases that came in there, like, they wouldn't have recognized me the next morning.
What are your ambitions now? What kinds of roles would you like to be doing?
That's hard to tell. I somehow don't see myself as getting older. I keep looking to see if when my hair's going to turn gray or when I'm going to get back the pot belly I had when I was in my 40s. It's not there. I look pretty good. And I just keep thinking, what is there around for me? You know, there isn't too many parts for older guys. You hit a certain age and it stops. You're not a leading man, and you're not the competition for the leading man. You're almost too old to play the fathers and the police chiefs, and it creeps up on you. I don't know. I'd probably like to play somebody's grandfather who's very rough and tough, and either as an ex private eye or an ex cowboy or an ex seaman or something. Pretty much, I'd like to play myself. That's what I've been doing for 35 years.
What was your reaction when you saw people who you were working with become famous, like Jack Nicholson, who had one of his first roles in Little Shop of Horrors?
Now that's supposed to be the questions that hurt and really get in deep, but they don't. Jack and I were personal friends for a lot of years, almost from the time he started making movies. We became buddies, and the relationship stayed that way until he became a huge star, because there is a difference in lifestyles. It's not like your friend is making a quarter of a million or a half a million or even $1 million a year. That you can cope with. He's living a little better than you. But when a guy's making $10 million and $20 million, and I believe he made about $50 or $60 million on his last picture, it becomes almost impossible to maintain a relationship, a personal relationship, because you're either a part of the entourage or, you cease to be a friend. You become part of the group. So we drifted away from each other. When we see each other, we're friendly, and I think there's probably a great deal of respect for each other there. But as these guys made it, I try to figure out what is it that they have that I don't have. Why is it that the bright teeth or the straight nose or the whatever it is that makes them a star? What got them the edge? I didn't feel bad. I always figured this could still happen to me. Even now, I figure I could still get lucky. Something could come along, and I could get lucky and suddenly become hot. You don't have to be a leading man. You could be a John Goodman. You could be a character actor that gets lucky. Something comes along in your career. But basically, if you understand that it is fate, maybe not even that, it's luck. It's luck and not necessarily talent. You can live with it, because that luck could be yours too.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Actor Dick Miller. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist A.C. Green was saved from certain death by a heart transplant operation. Coming up, Green tells us about his new heart and his new life. A few years ago, conductor and composer Pierre Boulez made a six-part TV series on modern classical music. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz tells us how the music from that series survives the translation to compact disc. Well, do you think you're any closer to knowing who killed Laura Palmer? Do you still care? David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a weekend budget agreement was reached, the job now for the White House and congressional leaders is to get approval from lawmakers on Capitol Hill. But as NPR's Cokie Roberts reports, getting the agreement enacted into law will not be an easy task.
The cries came from both sides of the aisle under the Capitol Dome today. Republicans railed against the tax increases. Some Democrats joined them in that complaint, while others objected to the Medicare cuts. Liberals and conservatives jumped ship in droves, including conservative Republican House Whip Newt Gingrich, who was a member of the original negotiating team. That means it will be tough for party leaders to deliver on their promise to each other that 50% plus one from both parties in both houses of Congress would support a deficit reduction plan so that neither party got the political blame. Democrats called on President Bush to take to the airwaves in support of the package, and while the White House made no commitment for the president today, the vice president spent the day on the phone lobbying reluctant Republicans. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, there's a lot of skepticism about the weekend budget agreement between the White House and Congress, but the markets rallied today on lower oil prices and hopes that the Federal Reserve may act to stimulate the U.S. economy. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
For weeks, Wall Street has been watching the Federal Reserve, wondering when it would reduce interest rates. The Fed, in turn, has had one eye on Wall Street and the other on White House and congressional budget negotiators. Only a deficit-cutting deal that led the markets to push down long-term interest rates would enable it to lower short-term rates, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan made clear. Now that the budget summit has produced a package designed to cut the deficit $500 billion over 5 years, it's still uncertain what the Fed will do when its policymakers meet tomorrow. Analysts generally looked askance at the budget agreement, and it wasn't until oil prices took a $3 per barrel tumble that stock and bond prices mounted a strong rally. Higher bond prices mean lower long-term rates, but some question whether that trend will continue as the budget is debated in Congress. The Fed may feel compelled to ease credit anyway, though, in face of growing economic weakness. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
And word today that the nation's manufacturing economy went down last month for the third month in a row to its lowest level in almost 8 years. According to the National Association of Purchasing Management, the drop put the manufacturing sector at a level not seen since the first month of the current economic expansion in December of 1982. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 63 points to close at 2,515.84 on volume of some 202 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of almost 3-1 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. So, did you watch Twin Peaks? TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season opener later in the show. 2 years ago, conductor and composer Pierre Boulez made six programs on 20th century music for French television. The French record label Disque Montaigne has released a compact disc of excerpts from that series. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the booklet that comes with the CD, Passport Through the 20th Century, is almost as valuable as the music itself. Here's an excerpt from the disc, music composed by Edgar Varèse in 1923.
Does melody still exist? Is there still harmony rather than cacophony? Has rhythm given way to chaos? These are the questions Pierre Boulez knows that audiences are asking about contemporary music. The year 2000 approaches, he says, without the mistrust that surrounds 20th century art having disappeared. His six-part series for French television attempted to answer these questions, to show, he says, why he likes this music and why we should, too. Now there's a recording taken from the show, and it's more than just a souvenir. The musical selections, some of them only excerpts, were chosen by Boulez to accompany his comments about some fundamental aspects of modern music: melody, harmony, rhythm, form, timbre, and material, that is, whatever actually produces the sounds. These selections range from classic 20th century composers like Stravinsky, Webern, and Varèse to such key contemporary figures as Berlioz, Ligeti, Stockhausen, and Boulez himself, and they turn the educational experience into a wonderful concert. Here's the exquisite American soprano Christine Whittlesey singing one of Stravinsky's three Japanese lyrics. Boulez chooses this piece to illustrate how what he calls the prefabricated melodic shapes of 19th century music have been suspended, interrupted, and made less symmetrical but no less beautiful in our own century. As a 20th century composer himself, Boulez obviously has something quite personal at stake. He talks about his own work Éclat as an example of new directions in form, of how what he calls free choice now governs over traditional constraints and rigid frameworks. He asks if this liberty makes composing easier, and he answers, each work must create its own rules. Form is not, as is so often thought, a matter of theory or of abstraction. It is quite the contrary, the most direct and persuasive means of communication between the composer and the listener. Different 20th century composers sometimes found opposite ways of reinventing musical language. The analytic approach of Webern uses tone color as an essential dimension of composition, while Ligeti, Boulez says, likes to proceed by fusion or confusion. We no longer know with which instrument or group of instruments we are dealing. Here's Boulez and his Ensemble Intercontemporain playing one timeless minute of Ligeti's Chamber Concerto. Boulez is extraordinarily sympathetic to the bewilderment of contemporary listeners. He himself isn't absolutely sure where music is going to go from here. The TV script uses the traditional metaphor of travel, passport, voyage, journey. If you're willing to embark on the unsettling, maybe even dangerous, safari into the interior of darkest 20th century music, it would be hard to find a more knowledgeable or rewarding guide than Boulez.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Passport for the 20th Century, a journey conducted by Pierre Boulez, is on the French label Disque Montaigne. This is Fresh Air. A.C. Green was dying of congestive heart failure. His doctors told him his only chance at survival was a new heart. 2 years ago, at the age of 64, he became the first patient in a new heart transplant program at the St. Paul Medical Center in Dallas. His memoir, Taking Heart, is the story of his operation and recovery. Green is an essayist and columnist for the Dallas Morning News. He also teaches English at the University of North Texas in Denton. Green says you have to adjust to the beat of a new heart.
A transplanted heart tends to take a little bit longer to warm up and tends to take a little bit longer to settle down. For example, I walk out of the studio here and I may have to take a couple of steps and stop, but then my heart catches up. One of the reasons is that when your old heart is taken out, all the nerves around the heart must be cut surgically. And of course, at this point, we're still not able to reattach those tiny, tiny nerves. So the heart doesn't have its automatic system. The brain has to tell it, okay, get going. And that takes three or four beats.
The heart is metaphorically always thought of as the emotional center of any person. Have you had to stop looking at the heart in any metaphorical way?
No, it's kind of like the moon. You know, 1969, we put men on the moon. Well, I feel the same way about the heart. It may be a different heart. It may be a new heart, a better heart. But it's still my heart in that metaphorical sense that you mentioned. In other words, if I break my heart, it still can be broken. If I lose my heart, it still can be lost.
Now, you don't know whose heart you got.
I don't know who it is. I do know that it was a man because of my size. I'm about 5'10 and a half and weigh about 180. So I had to have a little larger heart. Hearts have no race, no gender. So if a big, big woman had been available, I might have gotten her heart. But I just know it was a man, and I understand he was about 31 years old at the time that I got the heart.
You know, in your book, you describe your condition by saying that your heart was dying. And I thought it was very interesting that you'd say your heart was dying instead of saying that you were dying. And I thought, in a way, this was the ultimate mind-body split.
Well, once again, that's the metaphor of the heart. I didn't think about my body dying. And at the time that it was, that the heart was probably at its worst point, not at its worst point, but when it was dying most, I was not thinking about me dying. I had detached myself almost from the heart as an organ. I felt as if I had two hearts. One of them was a physical organ, which was really getting bad, but the other one was a kind of overview of my whole self, that secondary definition of heart, which the dictionary uses.
When you were waiting for a heart, how were things prioritized? How was it decided which heart was going to be yours and who would come first on the waiting list?
Well, that's a real problem as far as the general transplant program across the nation is concerned. In my case, it wasn't quite that difficult since I was number one. I was the only one in this new program who was waiting on a heart. Of course, the first consideration in a heart is size and blood type, so that they had to find a heart that was big enough to keep me going, but not so big that it got crowded into that space. In the book, Dr. Ring says, oh, it's just a simple matter of making four cuts. Well, of course, that may be true, four cuts to get the old heart going out and then putting the new one in and getting it going. But at that point, the patient is really embarking on the true transplant life, because after 2 weeks or so, your medication is what's keeping you going. As a matter of fact, I'm still very, very careful. I have twice a day at 9 a.m., 9 p.m., I have to take cyclosporine and then take a lot of other medications. I take 22 pills and two liquids, as a matter of fact, per day. But it doesn't bother me in the slightest, since the alternative is not too pleasant to contemplate.
Could you give us a sense of what just the hospitalization and the surgical procedure cost you and what you had to pay after insurance?
Well, my insurance is the kind that you have a certain amount you have to pay initially. Then it goes to, I believe there's $2,000 you have to pay on a 30-70 basis. And then after that, it's complete coverage. So my initial costs were something like about $10,000 or $12,000. Now that was just for the hospitalization and the insurance going in. Also, that includes a lot of flying around I had to do. I had to fly down to Houston two or three times and back. But I would estimate that after over a period of years, unless things change greatly in the next two or three years, a transplant of any kind, liver, heart, lung, that sort of thing, will run well above $200,000 total. That's hospital, surgeon, medication, all that sort of thing.
Can you share with us some of the things that went through your mind during the 7 months that you waited for a heart?
Well, at first I was very hopeful. I was in the Houston program, Dr. Cooley's program in Houston, and they used to call every week and say, well, we still don't have your heart. And they had their transplant meeting every Monday. And the coordinator would call my wife and say, oh, Ms. Green, we talked about AC today. We just can't get him a heart. We can't get one a suitable heart. And then when I transferred to the New Dallas program, they said, that's fine, because maybe you can get one quicker up there. And as a matter of fact, I did, even though I didn't get one immediately even then. But as I got weaker and weaker, I began to realize that, to me, and this begins to be very philosophical, I wouldn't demand that the listeners agree with everything I say, but I will say this. Someone waiting for a transplant, any kind of heart, any kind of open heart surgery, any kind of what I call terminal possibility, has to have something to hold on to. You have to believe in something, whether it's God or philosophy or the surgeon or the medical technique. Something you have to hold on to, because you are literally at sea. There gets to be a point when nobody can tell you anything. Your doctor can't even tell you anything, except when we get a heart, if it works, you'll feel better. And so I would say the last 2 months of my waiting, when I was really living in my own separate world, even though my children were trying to be helpful and were very helpful, and my wife was actually dedicating virtually every hour of the day to me, I still had to have something that I could believe in, some reason to stay alive. And I just kind of developed some old down-to-earth philosophy right then, that life is good, and the best way to live it is to be as useful as you can be and quit getting. In fact, I've said, I don't fall into the stress pool.
In your book, you write that after the heart surgery, you ended up crying a lot for the first, I don't know, a few days or a few weeks after. Do you know why?
Well, that was a few days. I think that what I was doing, I was kind of asking myself forgiveness for all the wasted things I might have done prior to my heart. I don't want to sound religious or that kind of philosophically inclined, but I felt so good, and at the same time, I wish that things could have been better. I'd had a very happy life. I'd been married at that time. My wife at that time, she and I had been married about 35, 38 years. And I felt, and my children were all around me and they loved me. And I'd had And I just suddenly realized that I had been kind of mean with myself. And of course, if you're mean with yourself, you tend to be mean with other people. So I just, I was crying, asking myself forgiveness, I guess. But on the other hand, there were tears of joy. I just felt like I had a new life. I'd been given a second chance. And, you know, all of us, from time to time, we talk about a second chance. But to really have a second chance, really get one and recognize it, somebody said, well, how long do you think you're going to live? I don't know. When have I ever known how long I was going to live, or any of us? But at least I'm going to live every minute of it that I can.
Have you signed over any of your organs in case of your death?
I have signed a donor card. In fact, I've joked with the organ bank people in Dallas a lot of times about, well, look, this heart's only 33. If I go the hard way someday, I said, maybe we can give it to a third person. I said, I don't think it's picked up any bad habits with me, because so anything else, I'm of an age that mostly what they would use as far as parts is concerned, to put it in rather blunt terms, is it would be skin, tissue, and that sort of thing, possibly something from the eyes, and of course any organ they wanted. At age 66, I think my organs are in pretty good shape.
So if you don't mind my asking, what did the doctors tell you about how long you could expect to live as a heart transplant person?
At one point, 20 years was the record, but I haven't even tried to keep up the last couple of years. I suspect that I might have a pretty good future. I'm not even going to try to put it to the calendar. I will say one thing. Right after I got my heart and I knew it was going to work, I said to the doctor, I said, Ring, I'm 64 now. Can I live to be 100? And he smiled and he says, well, your heart can if you can keep up with it. So I just use that as my rule.
Well, I wish you very good health, and thank you very much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it.
A.C. Green's memoir is Taking Heart. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the new budget?
Well, we'll hear how the budget agreement is playing out among the backbenchers on Capitol Hill, also on the financial markets, and we'll hear how it's likely to affect different households in the U.S. Also, news of President Bush's speech at the U.N. on the Persian Gulf crisis, and some background on who armed Iraq all these years and what U.S. policy toward Iraq has been over the past couple of years. And also we'll have a report from reporter Ira Glass in Chicago about girls fighting. It's from a school where when the police come, it's very often to break up fights between girls.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most mysteries have solutions, but are we ever going to find out who killed Laura Palmer? Now that the season premiere of Twin Peaks has come and gone, David Bianculli has these thoughts on what the first episode told us and what we still don't know.
Lucy, you better bring Agent Cooper up to date.
Leo Johnson was shot. Jacques Renault was strangled. The mill burned. Shelley and Pete got smoke inhalation. Catherine and Josie are missing. Nadine is in a coma from taking sleeping pills.
How long have I been out?
It's 7:45 in the morning. We haven't had this much action in one night since the Elks Club fire of 59.
Things in Twin Peaks have always happened fast. One of the neat things about the show is that all the action in each episode takes place in a single day. Last night's season opener, though, ran off in a whole new direction. Last season's strangest Twin Peaks moment came when Agent Cooper, played by Kyle MacLachlan, had a psychic dream about a dancing midget. So maybe we should have expected this season to start with another of Cooper's psychic dreams. This one with a giant who speaks softly and carries some heavy clues.
The first thing I will tell you is there's a man in a smiling bag. The second thing is the owls are not what they seem. The third thing is, without chemicals, he points.
Obviously, series creators David Lynch and Mark Frost are piling up so many mysteries that they hope the Who Killed Laura Palmer question will almost be lost in the shuffle. We did find out, though, that the initial found under the fingernail of the previous victim was a T, which means that so far the killer has spelled out T-R. I just hope he's not spelling out Truman. Actually, Twin Peaks isn't spelling out much of anything. Instead, it's giving viewers a tour of the town from a whole new perspective, part psychological, part paranormal. We already knew that Cooper and Laura's mother had psychic visions. In the season premiere, we learned that Bobby Briggs's father and Laura's lookalike cousin Madeline and the surviving victim Ronette Pulaski are also psychic. Also, Laura's father's hair turned white overnight, and Laura's friend Donna turned dark overnight. She wore Laura's dark glasses and became the town's newest sex symbol. Meanwhile, one vision by Ronette at the end of the show showed us long-haired Killer Bob apparently murdering Laura Palmer. Killer Bob had been seen as a vision last season by both Cooper and Laura's mother, but in this new dream, Bob was interspersed with quick images of Laura looking evil and possessed. Now, is Bob real? Or is he an evil spirit who can occasionally become solid, like the good giant who took Cooper's ring? And did Bob control or possess Laura and make her do nasty things? And with Laura dead, is he controlling Donna now? The giant told Cooper not to search for all the answers at once, and that's good advice for viewers, too. Now, I'm not upset that the Laura Palmer murder mystery is taking so long to reach its destination. I'm just along for the ride, and I'm having a great time.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Jeffrey Wolfe on fiction, truth, and growing up with a father who's a con man. And saxophonist Maceo Parker tells us if it's hard work playing with the hardest working man in show business, James Brown. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.